Good morning. Welcome to this July 15th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are streaming live on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I am your host for this hour, Marie Stone. I'm on now with novelist Andrew Rowe, and in the second half, Rebecca Mackay will join me to talk about her latest short story collection, Music for Wartime. Andrew Rowe is the author of The Miracle Girl, published by Algonquin this year. His fiction has been published in Tin House, One Story, The Sun, Glimmer Train, Slice, The Cincinnati Review, and other publications, as well as anthologies 24-Hour Blues and Where Love is Found by the Washington Square Press. His nonfiction has been published in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, Salon.com, and elsewhere. He lives in Oceanside, and he joins me this morning. My huge pleasure to welcome him on. Andy, hi.
Hi, Marie. How are you doing?
Good. I'm good. Thanks for doing it. I love this book.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to hear.
Great, great book. So for those who haven't yet read it, I'm going to let you take us into it, kind of take us into The Miracle Girl, tell us where the idea came from and a little bit about the book.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. The idea actually came from a story that I heard about back in the mid to late 90s about a girl who was in a similar situation who lived in Massachusetts. And I kind of took that idea and really just went with it and reinvented. So the novel, it's centered around the title character, a young 8-year-old girl named Annabelle Vincent, who's been in a car accident. And as a result of this, she's in a coma-like state called akinetic mutism. That's the medical term. And what it means is that she's unable to move, she's unable to speak, and the doctors don't really know if she's aware of what's going on around her. And then in the wake of the accident, as her family's dealing with taking care of her and adjusting to this intense caregiving that's required for of someone in that condition, stories begin to circulate, stories that Annabelle is capable of performing miracles and healing the sick. The first instance is this: there's an unexplainable smell of roses in her room, and soon thereafter a family friend pays a visit, and she has been recently diagnosed with leukemia. And she makes a prayer to Annabelle, and then, lo and behold, she goes into remission. So these stories begin to spread, and soon people start coming to the Vincent home. They're lining up to spend time with Annabelle and make their particular entreaties or prayers or what have you. And the story gets picked up on TV and the internet. I should also point out it's the closing months of 1999 as the millennium was winding down, and this is where I usually like to insert my joke that's why I think of this as a historical novel. I mean, it's not that long ago, but it feels kind of far away in at sometimes. But so there's the story set among this millennial hysteria about Y2K and computers crashing and all this sense of reckoning and doom, and it just seemed like an appropriate time for a story about supposedly miraculous events. And the book really explores the question of belief and the mystery of belief. That's kind of the general setup. And then I should also point out that the story is also told through the points of view of multiple characters. So we see the story from Annabelle's mother, Karen, and her father, John, who is actually estranged from the family. There are chapters from Annabelle's point of view herself. And there's also a fairly large cast of secondary characters. There's a skeptic who's trying to disprove these supposed miracles and events. There's an elderly man who's dealing with his dying wife, a young priest who's investigating the case for the church and kind of coming to grips with his own belief and what he's interpreting and making of all these miraculous events. And so as based on all that, you know, the story or the book is about religious belief, of course, but it's also about our secular day-to-day, more common place beliefs, and really ultimately about people finding hope and meaning and purpose in the ordinariness of their lives.
Yeah.
So I'll stop there. I know it's a bit of a ramble, but
no, it's perfect.
I've heard other people describe the book much more succinctly and better than I have. So, but that's what I got.
It's so hard when somebody tells you what are these 300 pages about?
That's not easy.
It's always intriguing to me what captures, you know, as you're looking, you said you saw this in a newspaper, and kind of what captures your interest and what you think has enough traction to make a novel, and what intrigues you. And I was wondering, as you look across the arc of your work, because you've written in the short story form, in the nonfiction form, now the novel, kind of what gets your attention when you're thinking about what to write about, or do you feel like there's a center of gravity or common themes that emerge, you know, across the board?
There's a couple. I mean, it does really vary from story to story, and even book from book. So in the case of The Miracle Girl, it was actually a news story on 2020 that I first heard about the girl in Massachusetts. So that's what kind of sparked it. But, you know, in addition to that, I've always been fascinated by these stories of miracles and the way people make pilgrimages to these sites. And I've always wondered, well, what is it they hope to find there? I mean, are they there partly for the spectacle? Is there some sort of communal element to it? Do they really truly believe that their lives are going to be different after they visit these sites? And it also just felt like it could be a very sort of panoramic tool to just not only tell the story of the immediate family, but all the people coming. I mean, the original title of the book was actually Believers, and so from the beginning, it was always very much telling these multiple stories and how they're drawn to this girl. And the novel that I'm currently writing, it's also kind of inspired by a true a story that I read about in the New York Times. I'm a little wary of saying too much about the details, but it reading that story gave me the spark to kind of go forward into the novel, and it's, you know, knock on wood, so far so good. I mean, sometimes you hear about these stories or hear things, and you try to write a story or even a book, and they don't have the legs to kind of carry the story. I think in the case of The Miracle Girl, I feel lucky, and in the case of the current novel that I'm writing, I'm feeling that same a sense of luck, and that I've come upon a story that's really going to develop into a full-fledged work of fiction.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, and I assume that you wrote in the short story form just based on where your work was published before.
Yes, definitely.
And I was thinking in some ways you could, because I love the short story form, and I was thinking, you know, novels sell better than short stories, and
sure.
If I was ever going to
venture. That's what they say, right?
That's what they say.
Yeah.
It makes me sad.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, me too.
I thought, you know, if you're going to venture into the world of the novel, a great way to think about it maybe for a short story writer is kind of how you did this, where you came at it from different points of view. And they almost, I mean, you almost could say that it kind of feels like interconnected short stories where this cast of characters each has their own, you know, short story that obviously centers around the girl. But I was thinking for those people who are intimidated by the idea of, you know, writing a 300-page work when they work in a 15-page genre, maybe that's a way of dipping your toe into the water. And I wondered if you ever thought about it that way, or if this always was just a novel and just a big cast of characters and different points of view.
Yeah, I had always conceived of it as a novel, and it's not the first novel that I've written. So, I mean, just to kind of go back in the time machine a little bit, but after I graduated from college, I wrote a novel, and it was very much, you know, a straightforward novel with a central character, and that's one of those books that just never made it out of the drawer, thankfully. And then after that, I really started writing more short fiction, some of which finally, after many years of rejection, started to find their way into the world and get published in some of the magazines that you mentioned in your intro. So I was writing stories there. Then I started on another novel, which, again, was pretty much a straightforward novel, single point of view, very, very voice-driven. That novel, there was an attempt to get it out into the world. It didn't end up getting bought or published. And then at that point in time, I was pretty down, to put it mildly. And then I got contacted by another agent, and I eventually got The Miracle Girl to her. That was something I'd started years before. So it's kind of a little bit all over the map. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but it wasn't. Yeah. I don't think when I came to write The Miracle Girl, I wasn't thinking like, this would be a way to transition from short stories, because I'd already written like a couple of novels that are just not the interconnected, many character type of novels. Does that answer it.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate answer, because I was like, no, I'm just kidding. I was looking for the other one, but no.
No. Sorry. But I know that approach and that technique has certainly, you know, worked for a lot of people. And I think I listened to your interview with Austin Bunn, which I think was fairly recently, and it sounded like he was kind of having that similar approach, where at least there was a theme and or interconnectedness to the stories, and it can be a great springboarding to approach a novel as a next project.
Right. Well, getting into that, let's get in a little bit to the characters, because there's such a wonderful cast of diverse characters in here. You write from a woman's point of view just as strongly as you write from a man's point of view, and, you know, a child. I think it'd be very hard to write from an 8-year-old girl point of view. So
yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about accessing voice, accessing character. Who gave you the most trouble? Who was kind of the greatest pleasure to write? Some of your experiences with these characters.
Sure. Yeah. As far as the hardest, yeah, there are, as you said, there are a lot of characters, and I think one overriding challenge was just to kind of present that, but yet also maintain the book's overall unity. And so, whether or not I truly achieved that, I don't know. But I mean, it was certainly something that was on my mind as I was working on the book. I'd say as far as a character that gave me the most difficulty was probably the character of John, which is Annabelle's father, because he's done some not nice things. I mean, he has left his family. I mean, he's racked with guilt over being the one who was in the car with Annabelle that caused this accident, and really can't handle the aftermath of dealing. I mean, John and Karen's marriage had always been fairly rocky. Annabelle, as a child, there was always something that seemed a bit off about her. So she was already in this kind of strange, otherly state almost, and then it kind of goes to an extreme when she becomes the miracle girl, is what she becomes anointed by the media. But with John, he just does some things that aren't very nice, and there were certainly earlier versions, a whole long chapter that I wrote from him where he was just kind of, I don't know, partying, and just it was just not, I really liked some of the writing in the scenes, but it just didn't seem right. So I really had to find that balance of providing him with just being very remorseful, and he does want to kind of come back to his family and redeem himself for the crappy things that he's done. So trying to make him sympathetic was probably the biggest challenge of the characters. The other one that comes to mind too, and you mentioned writing from the perspective of an 8-year-old girl, which is something that I really didn't want to go there. I mean, that's like, how do you do that as a, I won't say how old I am exactly, but as a middle-aged person, a man, like, how do you access that voice? And so for a long time, I did avoid it. It really wasn't toward the latter part of the writing of the book where I finally just said, you know what, I have to do this. I mean, and so I wrote these chapters from Annabelle's point of view. They're fairly short, and there aren't a lot of them, but I felt that it just the book needed that kind of weight to have something from her point of view. And so what helped was that purposefully I wanted the voice to be a little unclear, as you could interpret it as being her in the past, or perhaps it's her in the present moment and she is thinking these thoughts. And it also just provided a bit of an entry point into her past and her character, as opposed to have her just being this body in repose who does nothing. So if you have that as a central character in your story, you're going to have to somehow address that to kind of make that person real and not just make them seem like a statue.
Yeah, indeed. Well, hats off. I mean, they all came off as fantastic.
Oh, and thank you.
Funny you should say that. John was one of my favorite characters.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that.
I don't know. I mean, I could speculate on why, but I think, you know, a lot of people like to identify with somebody who's not the martyr and somebody who does have a dark side and who's fully realized as a human being who has their flaws. And, you know, I don't know. It's easy to be the martyr in the story. It's harder to be the, you know, the suffering guy from the outside. Maybe.
Yeah. And he's certainly flawed. And there are a lot of people and a lot of the characters in the books have their own individual flaws. So it certainly fits in with the rest of the cast of characters.
Exactly. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Andrew Rowe. The book is The Miracle Girl. So what does your office look like in terms of organizing, keeping track of all of these characters, keeping track of their character arc? Do you write a voice kind of all the way through, or do you write the novel all the way through? Kind of, you know, do you have big charts on your wall of here's where this character is now and here's where they need to go? Tell me a little bit about organizing your brain around the novel.
Yeah, maybe lack of organization would be a better description. Yeah, as far as where I did at one point kind of just like map out in a kind of visual way like all the characters and how they would kind of intersect. So that was another one of the big challenges of the book, was just the structure, and that when you have a lot of characters in a book and you can get at a point where the story goes along and a character might disappear for 100 or 200 pages, and you bring that character back and like who is this? And the metaphor I like to use is when you're using multiple characters is that every time you introduce a new character, it's like throwing another ball in the air. So you know, as you go and you keep introducing new characters, now all of a sudden you have 5, 6, 7, 8 balls juggling in the air. And the reader knows that those characters, those juggling balls, are out there in the air. And so I just had to work hard to find points in the story where maybe the skeptic character is not, you know, it's not from his point of view, but somehow there's a reference to him at some point in time, or there's a neighbor across the street who's drawn to Annabelle, a woman named Mavis. And so just to have those characters appear, that was kind of another big challenge. I don't do heavy outlining. I don't do heavy charting. I tend to kind of just have it rattle around in my head, and this book I wrote it pretty much from start to finish, so I tried to kind of maintain the unity of the voice by doing that, as opposed to just writing all the sections from John's point of view or all the sections from the mother Karen's point of view. And that's not to say there weren't times where I didn't jump ahead if I had an idea about, you know, a particular scene or another character. I would work on that while it was kind of fresh and baking in my mind, but for the most part, it was just a straight linear march through the novel.
Yeah, I liked the sections with I guess you'd call them all of the minor characters. They kind of seemed like the Greek chorus sections is what I came to call them.
Yeah.
But it worked really well, even though they all had their disparate stories, to kind of clump them all together in this sort of, you know, background chorus, for lack of a better word, and I don't know, they were all so distinct from each other that it was easy to follow.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice to hear, because that was another concern, is that would it be too overwhelming? And that was also another challenge, is that how to present those secondary characters. And for a while in the construction of the novel, they would have their own chapters. And then again, it was just like too much time was, you know, spent, and there was too much bouncing back and forth. So finally, at some point, I came up with that idea of having these consolidated chapters, which, and it's funny you mentioned the Greek chorus thing. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think that certainly resonates, and it's kind of the purpose of those things too. And it just like opens the story up a bit. And then I also wanted to make sure those more secondary characters had their individual arcs in stories as well as the story progressed.
Right. And you don't want to have those characters just be, you know, flat people just to serve, you know, as foils for the other characters. And that worked really well.
Oh, that's good. Good to hear. Thank you.
And in terms of your revision process, I don't know how long ago you started the novel, but I always wonder, you know, I mean, you change as a writer so much, even over the course of, you know, 6 months or a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, how you keep that voice cohesive over the course of years of writing a novel, in addition to just the revision process itself. As well.
Right. Yeah, that is a big one. I started it a long time ago. So the first, when I first heard about that story of the girl from Massachusetts, this was back in the mid to late 90s. And I think at that point I kind of wrote what became the prologue and just jotted down some general notes and ideas that I had. And then it wasn't until about 2000 I spent about a year on it. And then I stopped, and I ended up writing this other book that I was telling you about earlier, because the book, The Miracle Girl, was getting too big and too unruly, and I wanted to finish a novel, so I went and wrote a shorter, more succinct first-person point of view story. But so when I came back to the Miracle Girl, I had this, you know, a big, I don't know, 300 or 400 pages probably of stuff, some polished, some not so polished. And so there was probably a really like a 4-year gap in there where I didn't really work on it all that much. So I tend to revise as I go, so I just kind of comb through and massage. So what I did was I just started going over what I'd previously written and tried to get back in the frame of the voice. Because the book, I mean, some of the there's some long sentences, and, you know, the language has its own kind of distinct tone to it, and so I wanted to retain that. But I did, I think during those intervening years, I probably changed as a writer. I might have been a little more sparse in my writing approach, but I did still feel like that type of voice and that kind of language was appropriate to the story, so I just continued to adopt it. I mean, I'd probably change it a little bit, but yeah, we change as people throughout the years, and we certainly change as writers throughout the years, and the book that I'm writing now is different. I mean, there's some similarities, but it's a very different language.
Yeah, I was going to say, what writing lessons did you take, having gone through this whole process with The Miracle Girl, that you're taking into your next novel, sort of writing lessons learned?
The main one that I'm taking over with me is just to try to get momentum, daily momentum. So I have 3 young kids and a day job, so my writing time is pretty limited. So so patience helps as well, but really to just work, even if it's working on it for an hour or even 5 or 10 minutes, just to invest a little time on a daily basis to generate that momentum to carry you over into the next day, and really just to enjoy those moments, brief as they are, when you're conjuring a world and the people who inhabit it, and just being able to savor the sentences and the paragraphs and those moments of creation and surprise and whatever it takes to get you through the long slog of writing a novel. So when I was writing The Miracle Girl, one of the things I'd do at the end of the day, I'd ask myself, well, did it get better? And if the answer was yes, you know, even if it was just tweaking a sentence, adding a comma, some little change, then I consider that a successful day. Again, I write slow anyways, and so it took a while to finish the book, but I think when you step back and look at the daunting task of writing a novel, there's a lot of reasons you can certainly derail yourself when you start thinking about the craft and the intricacies and, you know, what about this character, what about that character? I mean, all that neurotic stuff's still going to happen, but if for the most part you can maintain that daily momentum, that's going to help, or at least that really, really helped me.
As you're saying that, I was thinking how similar your relationship, not your personally, but a writer's relationship with their characters are to your relationship with your spouse or with your friends. And as much time as you invest in your relationships and as much time as you invest in your characters, you know, it just pays dividends, right?
Yeah, and it does. And the other thing, when you mentioned that came to mind too, is that there's the time that you spend writing, you know, at the page or at the computer or whatever your choice is. But then when you're not writing, I mean, you're still living with those characters. I mean, they're still in your mind. And I think I one time in an interview referred to it as the fiction fog. And you're still kind of living that. And so that can be a little detrimental sometimes when you're back in real life and you're just still somewhat or heavily absorbed in the world that you're, you know, creating on the page.
Exactly. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Andrew Rowe. The book is The Miracle Girl. We're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to bring up community of writers, and it doesn't sound like you have your MFA, but I know you're a veteran of SQUA and writerly workshops, making connections with other writers, and sort of, you know, writing is such a solitary activity. But it seems like you still have a strong community of writers out there. And I was wondering if you had any advice for how to develop that, you know, as writers are sitting alone in their offices right now, how they start to make those writerly connections.
Yeah. Yeah, and for a long time I didn't have those, and as you said, I didn't go through an MFA program, so I kind of lacked that sense of community. But the way I was able to get a sense of that was attending writers' conferences. As you mentioned, I attended the Squaw Valley Community of Writers for two times, and I can't recommend going there highly enough, and I was just back there. They invited me back as part of their published alumni reading series, along with our mutual friend Aline Ohanessian, and so it was great to kind of go back after all these years and read there. I also attended the Tin House Writers Conference up in Portland, which I highly recommend as well. So those types of conferences are very accessible, and of course there's lots of other ones as well. And I mean, I still keep in touch with the people that I met at those conferences, and I don't. I mean, I still don't share my stuff with a lot of other writers. A couple people were kind enough to read earlier versions of The Miracle Girl, and my wife's a reader for me, and of course my agent. But I think it's a little different now with social media. There's so much more ways to connect with other writers. So I mean, that's another avenue just to, you know, get into the mix. And I just for a long time I just felt very far away from the world of books and the literary world. But doing things like going to Squaw Valley and connecting with other writers online, it just made it much more tangible and real, whereas before all of that had seemed very far away.
Right. Yeah, you think about writers in the I was going to say the 1800s or even the 1980s.
And yeah, what did no they do?
I guess
letters, but yeah. But even that, yeah.
Right, exactly. Are there things we should have talked about that we didn't talk about? Writing advice that you have?
Oh, writing advice stuff? One other thing that I like to tell people, because it's something you probably don't, it's not one of the typical things, be nice to yourself as a writer. This was great advice I got from a wonderful writer named Roy Parvin, who I met while I was living up in Humboldt. But, you know, writers tend to beat themselves up a lot, or at least I do. I know a lot of writers do. And, you know, writing a book and trying to get it published, it's really a brave thing to do, and it's kind of a delusional thing to do. And it's just important to take those small victories where you can, and just to step back and just be nice to yourself.
I love that. That's pretty good. And where do we find you online?
You can find me, I'm everywhere, right? Yeah, you can have an author website. It's Andrew Roe, that's R-O-E, author.com. I'm also on Twitter at _AndrewRoe and Facebook. And my son finally convinced me to start an Instagram account, so I'm on just dabbling there. So I don't know what I'm doing there, but anyways, so I'm out there.
You're out there and you're loving it.
Yeah, I'm loving it. Yep.
Well, we're going to anticipate the next novel. I'm so glad to hear. I'm so glad to hear there's another one underway.
Oh,
so I can keep watching for your name.
Yeah, we're keeping the fingers crossed.
Fantastic, Andrew Roe. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Oh, thank you so much, Maria. I really enjoyed talking to you.
We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Rebecca Mackay will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. Past shows are up there. Upcoming shows are up there. We're on Facebook. We're on Stitcher. We're on Twitter, I hear, though I don't know anything about that. But my co-hosts do. Nicole Nelson, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I are here with you every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. I am Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Rebecca Mackay's work has appeared in Best American Short Stories, Best American Non-Required Reading, Harper's Tin House, McSweeney's, and Plowshares. It's been read on NPR's Selected Shorts and This American Life. She is the author of two novels, The Borrower, a book list top 10 debut, an Indie Next pick, and an O, the Oprah Magazine selection. She's also the author of The 100-Year House, which won the Chicago Writers Association's Book of the Year Award and was named a Best Book of 2014 by BookPage, Pop Sugar, Chicago Reader, and more. Rebecca was on the show last year with my co-host Nicole Nelson. You can find that interview up and available on our website if you'd like to access that. She is a recipient of the 2014 NEA Fellowship and lives in Chicago and Vermont. It is short stories we're talking about this morning. If you listen to the show at all or you listen to my interviews at all, you know what a fan I am of the short story form. So anytime I see another fantastic collection, I jump for it. This one is Music for Wartime. It is my huge pleasure to welcome Rebecca on. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Hey, thanks for coming back on.
Of course. Yeah, no, I love talking about short stories. And, you know, not as many people maybe want to talk about short stories, so I get really excited when someone does.
I saw that at some point you said they sell as well as dead raccoons, and I was like, oh, that's too bad.
That might have been at a low point that I said that. But honestly, you know,
it's probably true.
It's been going very well. It's just, it is funny, you know, there isn't the market for them among the general readership. I think the audience for short stories is really self-selecting.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. I mean, they're sort of, you know, a writer's writer genre, I think, probably. But
yeah, and, you know, I think about that. Like, I'll watch the Oscars every year, and, you know, then the stuff for the short films comes on, and I'm going to go get a snack because I haven't seen any of those because I love movies, but I'm, you know, those are for the film buffs, the filmmakers, the industry people, the people who are real fanatics. So I try to make my peace with it that way.
Yeah, right. Do you have a favorite form? I mean, did you kind of feel pressured into the novel, or are you just as happy in the novel area as you are in the short story form?
I'm really equally happy. I mean, the fact that I was publishing short stories long before my first novel came out, but then I led with two novels simply because those were done first. I wasn't quite sure at that point how these stories would fit together into a collection. Even though I had enough stories, I just didn't see how they could cohere at first, and then I finally figured that out. But I was looking at, you know, putting a story about reality TV next to a story about World War II, and that wasn't an easy juxtaposition. I finally worked it out, how they could coexist in the same collection. But no, the novels weren't anything anyone told me I had to write. They were ideas that I had that were novel-length ideas, and I was excited to do it. So I'm hopefully going to happily continue with both forms for the rest of my career.
Which is so great, because, I mean, there's so many people that I say, you know, their center of gravity really is over here, and yeah, they do that, but they don't do it that well. And
yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think some people can be, it can equally happen that people are pressured into writing short stories. Because you come through an MFA program, that's what people expect you to be writing. It's easier to get started publishing that way. And there are a number of writers who write short stories because they feel they have to, and then can't wait to abandon it for the novel. Right. And then you have the complete opposite. So.
Right, exactly. Well, before we get too far into the thick of it, so our listeners know what the heck we're talking about here, I'm going to give you a chance to just talk generally about Music for Wartime, how you worked out putting a circus elephant next to game show host next to, you know, the Holocaust. How the collection gelled.
You know, the title was where everything gelled for me. I sort of the theme and the title came to me in the same moment. Music for Wartime as a title, I think, not only gets at two of the main themes, being wartime or other conflicts and music or the arts, but also at their odd coexistence. And I think what the collection is really doing is asking the question of what it means to try to create beauty in an unbeautiful world, and what it means to try to make order out of chaos. Mm-hmm. And whether we're talking about, you know, someone who's a pianist who survived in prison and is giving his first concert after Ceausescu's Romania, or whether we're talking about artists pitted against each other in a reality TV show setting, they're fundamentally looking at different sides of that one question.
Right, right. And there's some historical, somewhat family autobiographical stuff sprinkled throughout that I thought at some point I read an interview where you said that really kind of connected the collection for you to insert sort of some of your own family history into it.
It did, yeah. I felt like there, you know, I like collections where the length of the stories varies wildly. Yeah. And I had a lot of longer stories, and I felt like I needed some shorter connective pieces. And I do have, my father was a Hungarian refugee after the failed 1956 Hungarian Revolution. I'm actually not writing about him, really. I'm writing, though, about his parents, who had a very strange time of it politically in Hungary in the 30s. My grandmother was a really well-known novelist, actually, in Hungary, a leftist, worked for the resistance. My grandfather was a member of parliament, and although he later turned and fought for the resistance, initially was the author of the second set of Hungarian anti-Jewish laws, which is, you know, kind of a heavy, weird legacy to grow up with. And And not yet quite ready, although I'm working on it to really sit down and write their story as nonfiction, because I think it needs to be told. But what I did in the collection is there are four short pieces that basically are dealing with they're not heavily researched, but they're the family stories I've been told, like the story of my grandmother using this old stage makeup to paint young female resistance workers' faces so they would look old, so they could go through the streets at night without being raped, basically. Mm. And that's a story I grew up with, which is a really weird family story, and then but then questioning how accurate that is and what things I don't know and what's been kept from me. So I think of it as sort of overtly fictionalized nonfiction.
Right, right. Now, there's a story in here, Suspension, April 20th, 1984, that I read that you wrote in grad school based on a writing prompt about a photograph. I was wondering if you still use writing prompts or exercises to generate some of the short stories or, you know, kind of how you get some of these off the ground.
I don't, actually, at all. I think I sort of end up giving myself writing prompts where I'll scribble something in a notebook and it'll say, you know, like I had something in a notebook for years that said tornado plucked chickens, and I never knew how I'd use it. I'd heard this fact that basically in a tornado, a chicken could basically be plucked alive and still be fine, but completely featherless after the tornado. And it's like, I have to use that. So I write it in a notebook, and, you know, 15 years later, I used it in something. I didn't start with that, but I'm looking for ways to inject new life into a story that I didn't know what to do with. So I guess in a way I'm sort of writing myself prompts. That story did. It's funny because it's changed so much, that Suspension story, since I wrote it in grad school. I don't think it probably has two words in common with the story I wrote back then. I think I believe in prompts. I give them to my students, my undergrads especially, and I think that my training from high school through graduate school in responding to prompts has allowed me to just think that way constantly. Yeah. So I'll hear a weird thing, and it's a prompt. And I know that that's a place where I can start a story or a place where I can go in. I can find that later in my notebook when I'm looking for something to pair up with a kind of a dud idea that's just sitting there. If that makes sense.
That's so great. I'm going to keep that chicken thing in my head for, I can already tell.
Everyone listening should write a tornado flick chicken story.
And then all send them
at once to the Kenyon Review, and they'll be so confused. It'd be awesome.
I love it. So let's talk a little bit about ordering the collection. You mentioned at the beginning of the interview, you know, kind of juxtaposing the seemingly strange stories next to each other in time and place and texture and length varies. So tell me a little bit about ordering, structuring the collection so that the whole collection, is, you know, as a whole, is telling its own story while the individual stories are kind of, you know...
Oh, yeah. No, this matters a lot to me. I think, you know, the last thing I wanted was just a pile of stories that I happen to have written. And, you know, it is a themed collection, and so maybe more so than some other collections, the arc of the whole was really important to me. It begins with, for instance, this very short story called The Singing Women, and it ends with a story where the last thing this woman hears as she exits his apartment building is a man and a woman singing together. And I wanted I wanted that echo. But also, you know, just throughout the development of certain ideas, there's the sort of slow reveal through these family stories that are threaded through of what my family legacy was. Additionally, I'm thinking about just the pacing of certain stories. I'm trying not to stick, you know, five really depressing stories together and then put two funny stories. It's a bit, I think about, you know, my sister back in the 90s had a morning radio show in Minneapolis, and I was still in college, but I got to come in and sit with her in the booth. And they had all of their, the songs that they would play, I don't know, this is, you know, ancient history, because it was, everything was on index cards somehow, but then queued up to different numbers that they could play.
Oh, yeah.
And on every index card, it had this whole system of symbols for, like, uplifting song or depressing song, and, like, the pacing of the song, if it was a one or a two or a three, based on, like, how fast the beat was. And then if it was a man singing or a woman singing, all these different things kind of plan the order, all this thought that goes into it that you wouldn't realize just sitting there in your car listening to the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about that. I thought about the way that albums are put together, were put together when we listened to whole albums, the way fashion shows are put together. So hopefully it works. I was changing things up until the last minute, but I think I got it how I wanted. I don't have regrets about the order.
It absolutely works. And because it's called Music for Wartime and there's a lot of music in it, and there's a wonderful Music Man story that I heard from your interview with Nicole where you were, that's a different topic.
Where I almost got sued, yeah.
Got sued. But clearly music is such an important part of your life. I think I read that your parents were big musicians as well, right?
Yeah, basically, my father especially, my mother almost majored in organ in college, which is interesting, and then went on to, both of my parents were linguistics professors when I was growing up, but my father was really, almost a concert quality pianist, and just, passionate about it, and would take me to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and knew a lot of musicians. We would have concerts in our home. There's a story in the book about a concert in someone's home that, just inspired by some of my childhood memories. And then my sister is a musician. She's a piano teacher now. She went to Oberlin Conservatory for piano performance. So in my family, it tends to specifically be piano. And then I sang happily, but not with tremendous talent in college. I was always doing like the traveling choir and stuff, but I was like the person kind of leaning over to listen to the person next to me in the traveling choir to see what I was supposed to do. I always loved music. I wasn't that talented at it. I think what I got was just kind of genetics and osmosis, but not any true spark of genius on the music front. I absolutely grew up with it. And I, it was between my father and my sister constantly practicing piano in my house, there was never not music.
Yeah, and I mean, there's such a musicality, I think, to writing. There's a rhythm to the words. And like you say, just ordering the collection is, like putting a symphony together where you're like, now more violin, now, more drum.
Yeah, no, and I think that musicality matters to me tremendously when I'm writing and then when I'm editing, to the point where, especially, I find myself doing this especially at the end of a short story, but I'll literally be tapping out the rhythm on the table. Mm-hmm. Not that there's a beat, I'm not turning into Dr. Seuss, but I will, absolutely edit based on the rhythm. And I think everyone should be doing that. I think that fiction writers should have the exact same relationship to sound as poets do.
Yes.
And when we feel like we can ignore that, it's when we get into trouble.
That is fantastic. My guest this morning is Rebecca Mackay. The book, short story collection, is Music for Wartime. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You had said that most stories are really two stories. And I think in the context of that, you were talking about the Story Museum for the Dearly Departed. But I was thinking about that in terms of structuring short stories, and if that's a way to approach a story that really there are two things going on. Well, in a lot of the powerful short stories that I've read, there are often two things going on that are in dialogue with each other.
Right.
And I wanted you to sort of expand on that thought, if that's a conscious thought that you have when you sit down to write short stories of trying.
It
to
is
do
actually basically I trained myself to do this where. And I'm not sure where it came from except just experience. I think I can remember the story that I finally figured this out on, which is not a story in the collection. But I feel like if you start with one idea, you're like, I have this great idea, and you just start writing, it's like you're just pushing this one rock up the hill forever, and there's no space in the story. There's no space for meaning. Whereas what I'll literally do is I'll find the one idea, and unless it's already a tremendously multifaceted, complex idea, it usually isn't, even if I think it is at first. Like when I was talking about Museum of the Dearly Departed, the last story in the collection, I had this idea for this apartment building where there was a gas leak and all these people died and the survivors are going through their things. And that seems like a complex idea, but it's still really just one idea. So what I'll do is I'll go through my notebook or through my computer files and I will matchmake the idea with other things I've jotted down, like tornado plucked chickens or whatever, that was not the one that, that ended up going into this story. And in that case, it was, the story about this older woman who kind of met her husband in a very strange way, and I decided to put them into this apartment building and have my main character interact with them. And in some stories, it's harder after the fact to pluck out the two threads, but and sometimes for me, you know, it's not just finding one other thing, it's finding two or three other things, so that I'm really building sort of an echo chamber. I have these far-flung ideas, and it's the space between them where you find the meaning, just as with a simple metaphor. It's the space between the tenor and the vehicle where you're going to find the meaning, the illumination that comes from that metaphor.
Yeah, perfect. Right. The other thing, you had some advice about not including a lot of the physical descriptions of characters in short stories, which I thought was very interesting. I've never thought of that before, but, you know, you have a very limited amount of space and time in a short story to convey a lot, and so don't waste it on what people look like, I suppose. But you said, you know, you really only need their name unless there's something that, you know, you obviously need to tell the reader about.
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, I think I'm not sure what context I was saying that in, but and it's something that I often push myself to do more of. I realize I sometimes underwrite physical description, and that there are times, you know, when I'm reading physical description and I absolutely love it. It tends to be more in a novel, though, where, you know, I'm going to not only need to live with this person for 300 pages, but really remember who he is if he disappears for a few chapters and comes back. And that kind of thing is going to help. So I think what I might have been overstating my case, but I think what I was arguing in favor of is just the one salient detail, the buck teeth or the big ears or the beautiful leg muscles or whatever, or, you know, if the character's name is Dwight or something, like, we're going to remember that because it's a strange, or not strange, but, you know, it's a slightly unusual name that carries some connotation with it. Versus if a character's name is Joe. You know, so I'm in favor of, like, you give us a memorable name, give us one thing to latch onto, and we can fill in the rest. And the one thing I hate is, and I think I'm not alone in this, is, like, where someone will be introduced, and then we'll get to know them, and when, like, 17 pages later, suddenly we're given a physical description, and you've already formed your own mental picture of this person, and then I'd, like, reject whatever physical description the author is giving me. Like, no, she does not have red hair. I already have her in my mind. Shut up. And then my vision is totally at odds with the author's vision. So I think if you're going to – whatever you're going to give, you got to give it right away.
Right, right. This question might not apply as much now, because I was going to say, are there rules that you have for novel writing versus rules that you have for short story writing that are, you know, somewhat at odds with each other? But
I mean, I think that's one of them.
Yeah.
In a novel, we do need to know more about the people. We need a sense of their physicality. I think that maybe we don't need in a short story quite as much. And then, you know, in a short story, a character can serve just one function, which is not to say that they should be caricatures, but a character can just be in a short story to be, you know, the lousy boyfriend or something, and that's kind of all we need to know. Whereas in a novel, characters have to be multifaceted. We have to have arrows pointing more than one direction within that character. You know, if you're going to make someone bad, they have to also be a little bit good.
Right.
And if they're, you know, if they're sentimental, they have to also be a little bit jaded in some other unexpected way. They can't be all one thing. Because the novel is trying to mimic more the scope of real life, and in real life, people are complex.
Right, right.
Not that they're not in short stories. Like, that might have, you know, I think with the short stories that we're seeing, we assume that what we're seeing in those 15 pages is a slice rather than sort of a replica of the whole.
A life,
you know,
yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
We as readers are able to sort of fill in the gaps and assume that this is one small part of a larger personality.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about titles, because they're really tricky for me personally. And the hard part of short stories is you have to come up with so damn many of them, you know?
Yeah, right.
It's not just one for the book. It's, you know, 16 of them. And yours are wonderful. They have to be resonant. They can't be too obvious. I mean, there's so many things I think that go into titling a short story just right. And I wonder if you have any tips and tricks for how you go about doing that.
Well, I can tell you, for whatever reason, it's much easier for me to title a short story than to title a novel. Both of my novels were titles that were not originally on the book, and that, like, my agent and editor and I came up with at the last minute after frantic back-and-forth emails. Which is funny, actually, because you look at a title like for The Borrower, people have asked me if I started with the title, because we ended up with something that I think felt so central to the book, but it was just not obvious to me for many years while I was working on it. For story titles, the good thing is you don't have to worry about them being commercially appealing. You don't need a title as you would with a novel. With a novel, you need a title that someone's going to look at it in the bookstore and have some clue what the book is about.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't know, otherwise it's just not an invitation to the story. With a short story, people are kind of in it already. You know, I needed to think about the title of the whole book, but the individual short stories, I don't have to worry about that. You know, I think that they need to be sort of evocative, and it helps if they're a little bit mysterious. You know, I have a story called The Miracle Years of Little Fork, or The Museum of the Dearly Departed, which we were just talking about, where it sort of, it raises a question in its sort of strange specificity. It's not obviously apparent what the story is going to be about, but there are enough specifics there, hopefully, that you're intrigued.
Right.
You know, I think for me, it is sometimes a matter of going through the story and seeing if there's the one word I can pull out, the one line I can pull out. I also, though, for stories, titles will just occur to me. And I have, you know, in my notebook and my computer file, I have just 20 random titles that probably I'll never use. That I'll, you know, sometimes pull them out. And there's a story in the collection called Good St. Anthony Come Around I had the title before I had the story. I had the title for several years. It's part of this sort of Catholic prayer. If you lose something, you're supposed to do this Good St. Anthony Come Around. Something's lost and must be found. And I found that someone posted it once on Facebook, and I was like, that's really cool. I want to use that as a title. And then meanwhile, I started writing this story about these artists and the AIDS epidemic, and really the matchmaking that I was talking about earlier happened with that title. I just felt like it was a fit for the story, this idea of something's been lost, this whole generation had been lost. And then when I put the title on it, I realized, too, that I could have an individual person in the story go missing. So the title kind of made the story for me. So I wouldn't discount that. You know, when you just think of a title, even if you don't have a story to go with it, just writing it down and seeing if, not if you can slap it on something that pre-exists, but that if someday the title itself can't enter into the creative process and give meaning to something that you're in the process of writing.
That's so great. I'm desperate to see your notebooks. Your notebooks sound fantastic.
They would make no sense. It's okay. The one like, oh God, you know, I hope I'm never under investigation for some crime because just the notes of a lunatic.
There's a lot of plucked chickens and tornadoes and
St.
Anthony. Is it, do you just have sort of a notebook that you carry around everywhere routinely, or, I mean, do you have a kind of a process?
No. I have various notebooks where I'll write things down, but mostly, honestly, I type things into my phone. And then, you know, like the notes transfer over to my laptop because it's a Mac, and then I like cut and paste those into this file that I call eNotebook, and I just have pages and pages. And sometimes I'll be in there and I'll start writing. Like I'll be looking through my ideas and I'll start jotting notes about something, and then I'll jot more notes, and then I'll jot more notes, and then I'll realize I have like 7 pages of a story in the middle of this file. And then I'll just transfer it out and keep going.
I love
the physical notebooks too, because I can lose them for a few years and then find them again. And then there's this really strange distance. Yeah. Usually I remember what the note was about. Once in a while, I have no clue.
Yes.
But you know, I'll find the notebook again, and it's like, wow, these are things I haven't thought about in years, and they're sort of freshly strange to me, which is nice.
Yes, like somebody else wrote it or something. It's great. That's great.
Right, it is a prompt. We started talking about prompts. You know, like this is a prompt that I gave myself 7 years ago, and now I'm going to do something with it.
Right. I could talk to you for all day. So you're going to have to just keep generating books at this 6 month pace, so that we can keep having you on.
I'm on it.
Oh, sadly, we're out of time. Where do we find you online? All over the place, I found.
I have a website, which is my name, Rebecca Makkai, MAKKAI.com. But I'm also on, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff. And you can find my events. I still have a lot more events coming up for Music for Wartime. You can find my events on my website as well.
Fantastic. Rebecca, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks for coming back on, and we'll look forward to having you on yet again when the next one comes
up.
Yeah,
when I write the Tornado Pluck Chicken Book. Awesome.
Exactly. We'll talk more about chickens.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Rebecca Mackay. The book Music for Wartime is out and available now. This interview will be up on the web shortly, and you can access us at penonfire.com, as I mentioned earlier. We're here with you every Wednesday morning. I can't remember if it's Nicole or Barbara. We'll be back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up next with a little bit of reggae to keep your Wednesday morning going. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.